All rise. The Chief Judge and Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. I'm Scott Stuckey, Chief Judge of the Court, and we're very happy to be here and have availed ourselves of the great hospitality of BYU Law School. At this time, it's my pleasure to transform the moot courtroom here at the J. Reuben Clark Law School at BYU into the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. In doing so, the court thanks Dean Gordon Smith, Professor Eric Jensen, Professor of Law, Coordinator of the LLM program, for their leadership and many efforts to make this possible. And with that, the court calls United States versus Rice. Counsel for the appellant, prepared to argue?
No, Your Honor.
For the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for the appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, may it please the court, I'm Steve Vladek, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Carrier, and Captain Zach Gray, I represent the appellant, Colonel Robert Rice. With the court's permission, we'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Your Honors, this case presents a unique and uniquely serious double jeopardy issue, which, begging the court's indulgence, is perhaps best understood as a product of four distinct developments. First, in May 2016, appellant was tried and convicted in federal district court on two counts: possession of child pornography and distribution of child pornography. The former count, which we refer to as count one, is what matters here. Second, the next month, appellant moved on double jeopardy grounds to dismiss three of the specifications on which he had been charged before a general court-martial because they were either the same offense as count one or because count one was a lesser included offense. In October 2016, the military judge denied appellant's motion, after which appellant and the government agreed to a conditional guilty plea only to the three challenge specifications. Appellant was sentenced by the military judge consistently with that agreement. Third, having been sentenced in the court-martial, appellant next moved to prevent the district court from also sentencing him on count one on the ground that being sentenced a second time for the same offense would be a separate double jeopardy violation. The government did not oppose that motion, and the district court declined to sentence appellant on count one, instead dismissing that conviction, but not count two. Fourth and finally, in appellant's appeal of his court-martial convictions, the Army Court held that appellant received a complete remedy for the double jeopardy violations when the district court dismissed count one. As Judge Wolf wrote below, quote, as long as the results of one trial go away, the Constitution is not offended, unquote. Your Honors, with all respect to the Army Court, that conclusion was wrong as a matter of both law and fact and would have drastic implications for the double jeopardy clause were it to be affirmed.
So, counsel, in your view, in what fashion could a remedy, what remedy is it that you actually seek?
The remedy we seek, Judge Ryan, is dismissal of the court-martial, of the guilty plea, of the convictions that are on appellant's record in the military court. We believe that because the double jeopardy violation we are appealing arose from the successive prosecution in the court-martial, it is only through dismissal of the court-martial that the double jeopardy violation can be remedied. Now, part of why we think that's true is because in the district court had no power.
So, just to be clear, please. So in that sense, the so-called windfall of the going away of count one of the federal district court conviction is merely based on the military system failure to dismiss the UCMJ offenses in the first instance.
So Judge Ryan, I think there are a couple of different things that could have happened below that might have avoided this problem. So for example, the military judge obviously could have correctly granted our motion to dismiss the charges, but even once that didn't happen, when we went back to the district court and moved to avoid sentencing on count one or have count one dismissed, the government at that point could have asked the district court to delay sentencing The government could have said, we are trying to fix this within the military court system. We are trying to fix this either by having the convening authority disapprove the findings under Article 60, or by seeing what the Army Court rules on appellant's agreed upon appeal. The government didn't say either of those things. And so the district court was left with no choice, because the existing sentence appellant faced by dint of the court-martial would have been duplicative. A second sentence on count one would have been a second double jeopardy violation. So our position is that this, what the Army Court called debacle, could have been avoided at any number of steps below. The problem is that now we're here. And we're here because of the unique way this case unfolded, where the appellant, I think it can fairly be said, did everything he could at every point to preserve his rights.
Okay, Mr. Vladek, describe exactly what you mean by the two double jeopardy violations.
Of course, Chief Judge Stuckey. So the we believe, and we've submitted, and the Army Court found, that the court-martial specifications, all three of them, all three of the specifications to which appellant pleaded guilty, were violations of the double jeopardy clause. We treat that as the first double jeopardy violation. That was a successive prosecution violation that arose from the Army trying appellant for the same offense as count one. Once we went back to the district court, appellant by that point had already been sentenced by the military judge pursuant to the plea agreement. And so for the district judge to have then sentenced appellant on count one would have been a multiple punishment violation, because it would have been imposing a second punishment for the same offense.
Okay, so he got what he asked for in district court.
With regard to avoiding a second violation, Chief Judge Stuckey.
Leave that aside for the, yeah. He got relief in district court.
So I guess he got relief in the sense that the district court did not commit a second
violation.
Your
contention is really that multiple prosecutions are barred by the clause.
It's not just my contention, Your Honor.
What authority is there for that assertion?
So, I mean, I think we cite in our briefs a number of Supreme Court cases stressing this point. I think the one that really goes the furthest to underscoring why we're right here is Abney. So in Abney versus United States, Your Honor.
Abney. Okay.
And in Abney, what the Supreme Court held, Abney was a jurisdictional case where the question was whether a civilian criminal defendant in the federal system could appeal the denial of a motion to dismiss, where the claim was that the second trial was violating the Double Jeopardy Clause, at an interlocutory stage. And the Supreme Court said absolutely that was the quintessential immediately appealable interlocutory ruling, because the right protected by the Double Jeopardy Clause was a right wholly independent of the result of the second trial, right? That it was the right not to be tried as opposed to a right not to be convicted. And we think that's the issue here, right? That yes, it is possible to look back on what happened in appellant's case and say, well, at this stage of the proceeding, there's only one offending conviction on the books. But with respect, that's not how the Supreme Court has ever understood the Double Jeopardy Clause. And were it to be understood that way, then the government would have the ability to prosecute defendants 2, 3, 6 times, so long as it picked one sentence to defend on appeal. We believe that that's deeply inconsistent with the Double Jeopardy Clause. We think it would incentivize the very kind of governmental overreaching that the Double Jeopardy Clause exists to prevent. And we think that the alternative rule would actually cause neither harm to the government nor an unjustified windfall to appellant.
So, counsel, as you know, but the people listening to the court may not know, right, for double jeopardy to be implicated, it has to be the same offense, correct?
Yes, Judge Ryan.
Okay, and the government has argued that because the federal statute, like all federal statutes, in order to be prosecuted, in order for Congress to have the authority to pass those statutes, there has to be something that ties it to a jurisdictional hook, right? In this case, it was that the child pornography was transported by a means of interstate commerce, et cetera, et cetera. The government says that because that element is not part of Article 134, Clause 2, that you don't have the same offense. Can you address that point?
Happily. So first, I think it should be noted that the government did not actually seek cross-certification of that issue when it came to this court.
I understand that, but just for purposes.
Of course.
I'm not asking you to concede that they
fair enough. Assuming this court were to reach the question, we think there are two different problems with the government's position. The first is that, yes, it is true that elements of federal offenses must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt by to the jury. But the Supreme Court has made clear over and over again, in every context in which it has arisen, that jurisdictional elements do not have the same relevance to analysis of whether two offenses are the same. There's no double jeopardy case on point, Judge Ryan, but
so
in the-
you're talking about the assimilated ACCA and-
Assimilated Crimes Act.
So ACCA, both the Assimilated Crimes Act, Judge Ryan, and in the context of whether a state offense is an aggravated felony
right.
purposes of federal immigration law, we cite in our brief the Supreme Court's Luna Torres decision, the Supreme Court's decision earlier this year in the Rahafe case, and of course the Lewis decision from the 1990s about the Assimilated Crimes Act. In all of those contexts, the Supreme Court said jurisdictional elements are not part of the underlying substance Congress is trying to prohibit, and are merely Congress tying the criminal prohibition to its constitutional regulatory authority.
So what are we to make of the Supreme Court's sort of ignoring the jurisdictional issue in the Gamble case, right? I mean, Gamble was a dual sovereign issue, right? The state and the federal government laws, which obviously would be different, right? And so the majority in that case in footnote one basically said, we'll assume for the sake of argument that it meets the Blockberger, that it is the same offense.
And I think, so with respect to Gamble, first of all, if I recall correctly, the offense in Gamble had a different structure than 18 U.S.C. 2252AA5, the statute
right.
issue here. But putting that aside, Judge Ryan, the other thing is, an assumption the court makes in a footnote, I think, can hardly overcome the express holdings the court has reached in other, but I think deeply on-point contexts. Right, in the context of...
Well, it would actually help you, right? I mean, what they said in the footnote would actually help you, right?
Oh,
they're assuming that they're the same, even though that federal statute has a slightly different jurisdictional hook.
I'm just loath to rest on assumptions, because
right.
I think we have stronger arguments in the Supreme Court's holdings.
Okay.
And I think part of... But Judge Ryan, part of why this problem, I think, occurs so infrequently, part of why there isn't squarely on-point case law, is because the facts of this case are so unusual. Right, that in Gamble it was an issue because in Gamble you have the specter of overlapping state and federal offenses. It's not that typical that you have the specter of overlapping federal offenses.
Well, I'd like you to address that point, right? Which is my understanding, just based on like the petite policy in the Department of Justice. Just usually, if it's the same sovereign, isn't it usually the case that they choose which arm of the sovereign is going to prosecute?
That's my understanding as well, Judge Ryan. I'd be certainly interested to hear what my colleague representing the government has to say. But you know, we don't dispute, Your Honors, that the government could have found a way to try appellant in both civilian court and a court martial without offending the double jeopardy clause. And indeed, I suspect that's part of what was attempted in this case. The problem is that I think it's now clear that's not what happened.
Right there, are you talking about in state, in military, or are you saying an AUSA could have tried it on behalf of the federal government by separating out the underlying facts of what occurred?
So, Judge Olson, I would say not the underlying facts, but actually the physical material, right? The units of the offense. That if, for example, the government had tried to divvy up the laptop computer from the external hard drive, and had civilian prosecutors prosecute just what was on the laptop, and have the military prosecutors just on the hard drive, this would be a different case, because I think the government would have a much stronger argument that the units of that the offenses weren't factually duplicative. Here, that's not available to them, because the same evidence was introduced in both proceedings, covering the same images on the same dates. And so back to Judge Ryan's point, this is why we think this is actually such an easy case on the double jeopardy question. These are clearly the same offenses so long as we look past the jurisdictional element. The Supreme Court has never suggested that a jurisdictional element should count for double jeopardy purposes. We think Luna Torres and Rahafe are pretty strong evidence. The footnote in Gamble, circumstantial evidence to the same effect.
Well, Justice Gorsuch, I mean, obviously thought they were the same offense too, right?
And I think the other point that I would just make to Your Honors is that it also avoids the difficulty of wading into the thornier question of how to treat terminal elements in Article 134. Without even getting into whether the terminal elements of Article 134 are ever or sometimes entitled to similar distinguishing, You don't need to reach that question because so long as the interstate commerce element doesn't count, count one is at worst a lesser included offense of both the possession specifications to which appellant pleaded guilty and the distribution specification to which he pleaded guilty.
Mr. Vladek, what about the hurdle that seems to be in the way of your argument, created by us, I might say, in U.S. v. Roderick? Now, your position, for the court to adopt your position, wouldn't we have to revisit United States versus Roderick?
So, you know, Judge Sparks, I think there's a lot going on in Roderick. I took the discussion of the offenses in Roderick to be specific to that, to the fact pattern the court was presented with there. I'm not sure this court would have to overrule Roderick. I think you could just distinguish it to its facts. And frankly, given the Supreme Court's consistent guidance in the 13 years since Roderick was decided, I think that's the most obvious option for this court, is to say Roderick was dealing with a different situation. We have clarification from the Supreme Court that all things being equal, jurisdictional elements should not count. And if I may, just really briefly, there are some elements in federal criminal statutes that look jurisdictional but actually are substantive. When Congress says, for example, a criminal prohibition applies extraterritorially, that's not a jurisdictional element in the sense that the Supreme Court uses the term. That's Congress just applying the substantive prohibition to different parts of the world. So I think some of the cases that are out there, Roderick, other cases in the civilian courts, don't necessarily implicate the rule that we think follows from the Supreme Court's decisions.
Yeah, let me, counsel. No, I was going to have a follow-up, and then I'll be with Judge Mack.
Judge Sparks.
My question then is, most of the cases dealing with the so-called jurisdictional element are state cases. The comparison is between state and federal offenses. Does it matter that we have a situation here where you have a federal offense and a military offense? Does it matter with respect to how we should treat this jurisdictional element? Because remember, no state could ever have an interstate commerce component to it. Whereas in the military, under Article 134, the military could actually prosecute someone for this exact offense to include the jurisdictional element.
Judge Stuckey, I see my time is...
Please answer the question.
Thank you very much.
Do you know what I'm asking you?
I do, Judge Parks. And I guess, if anything, I think it actually cuts in the other direction. That I think, if anything, the argument is even stronger when you have a federal-federal comparison. Because in that context, you don't have the awkwardness of trying to match up offenses prescribed by different legislatures. It's the same legislature. And so I think it's telling that in context where all the Supreme Court was doing was interpreting the Assembly of the Crimes Act, or the aggravated felony statute, where there were no constitutional implications, the court was still wary of treating as the same offense offenses with a federal jurisdictional element. I think that has to follow a fortiori, if not more strongly, in the context where it raises constitutional concerns.
Judge Maggs.
Well, perhaps after on rebuttal, you could address the question. If we are to ignore the jurisdictional element in a statute under the Blockberger test, how do we define what is a jurisdictional element? This goes to your answer to Judge Sparks. Every federal crime states the jurisdictional element in a different way. And what exactly is the test for saying, because we can't just say, oh, you ignore jurisdictional elements. We have to define what they are.
I'm happy to take that now, Chief Judge Stuckey, or save it for rebuttal.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So, Judge Maggs, we would have two answers first, which is, I think this is the easiest possible case, because I think it's clear from the text and structure of 2252A5 that the interstate commerce language is simply doing jurisdictional work. And so, at the very least, I think this court could say that where a federal criminal statute has an interstate commerce element, I don't think you even have to get into broader differentiating between jurisdictional elements. Just interstate commerce is unique. There's no reason why Congress is seeking to substantively prohibit interstate commerce activities beyond tying it to its regulatory authority. And so I think this case is an easy case. If you wanted to go further, Judge Max, I think there is guidance to be divined from the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in the statutory context, where the court has said jurisdictional elements are not always obvious, but we can find them. And the question would just be on a case-by-case basis, is the language in the statute going to the heart of the offense Congress was seeking to prescribe, or is it simply Congress tying the underlying proscription to its regulatory power? That test will produce hard cases, Judge Maggs. With all respect, we don't think this is one of them.
So I have two Well, one, if you could address Grafton on rebuttal, I would, like, how does that play into the analysis here? And then second, this is sort of a quirky thought, but does Article 134, Clause 2 require that the child pornography be transported by any particular means?
If I may, I'll take those on rebuttal.
Okay.
Oh, unless you look at me.
Does Article 134 require that the child pornography be transported by any means, like by a particular means? And mm-hmm. if the answer is no, does or does not the requirement that the child pornography be transported by a particular means constitute a lesser included offense?
Fair enough. You've already been generous, Judge Shuka. Yeah. I'm happy to save that for rebuttal.
I have one question that
Please.
You can take on rebuttal as well. This case started out with a written PTA. And then they sauntered off into a non-written conditional plea, something they're not supposed to do, but they did it anyway, which is one of the reasons we're sitting here and scratching our heads. At any rate, he entered a conditional plea, so far as the record shows, entered a conditional plea to preserve his motion on double jeopardy. It wasn't reduced to writing except in the record of trial. It should have been, but that's another matter. But that motion that he wanted to protect and protected did not include the business about the possession offense being an LIO of the distribution offense. It not being preserved, is it not waived? Take that on rebuttal.
You've already been generous. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Major Catherine Parnell, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Stephen Haight, I represent the United States. This court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case because appellant's convictions do not violate the Double Jeopardy Clause. If this court were to find a constitutional violation, it should not issue a remedy because appellant no longer has a constitutional right to vindicate. The Army Court erred in this
case. Could you speak up a little, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm having trouble understanding you.
No problem, Your Honor. The Army Court erred in this case when it found that appellant's convictions violated the Double Jeopardy Clause, primarily because the Army Court analyzed this case under Clause 3 of Article 134 rather than as it was charged under Clause 2. This is no small matter. Clause 2 prohibits conduct which is service discrediting and is a specific basis for criminal liability under Article 134. Thus, when the government charged this case under Clause 2, it charged a different offense than that which was charged in the federal district
course. In fairness to the Army Court, I don't think that it analyzed it as Clause 3. I think that it said if they had charged this as Clause 3, which is it completely incorporates Article 18 U.S.C. 2252 Alpha, it would be a clear violation of the Double Jeopardy Clause, right? Because it would be the exact same statute. And then they went on to say, and they cannot do by via Article Clause 2 what they could not do under Clause 3.
Yes, Your
so
Honor.
So that's a slightly different point than the one that you're attributing to them.
Yes, Your Honor. There are some different points nestled in there. They also discuss United States versus Williams and discuss whether the Article 134 separate clauses are different sort of forms of criminal liability. Although their conclusion that the Army could not have charges under Clause 3 does not preclude us from charging under 1 or 2 under Martinelli, Medina, the line of cases that discuss the separability of Article 134 Clauses 1, 2, and 3. It is conceivable that in a different case, putting aside the federal convictions, that the Army could have charged a specification in which we alleged 1, 2, and 3, or any combination.
But don't you see a slight difference between charging for contingencies of proof, perhaps, under Clauses 1, 2, and 3, and with the defendant having the ability to argue either at findings or sentencing that they're multiplicious, right? From having two successive prosecutions in two distinct federal forums for what is essentially the exact same conduct.
Perhaps, Your Honor, although clauses 1 and 2 do provide the Army with an opportunity to vindicate a specific military interest.
Are you familiar with the Grafton case?
I am not, Your Honor.
Okay, United States versus Grafton is a Supreme Court case from some time ago where basically the Supreme Court said there's no such thing as a separate, distinct military right to vindicate. It's the same federal sovereign, and if one sovereign's power is the basis, the source of power for one court, that's it. You don't get to have another court.
And yet, Your
from
Honor...
The, from the same... And if you're not familiar with the case, I'm sorry, but you should be.
Noted, Your Honor. But understanding that Article 134 does provide us these three separate bases under which to charge this offense, the article with Clause 1 and Clause 2 offense for service discredit and prejudice to good order and discipline is still a valid charge under Article 134 for these child pornography offenses. And the Army Court erred when it found that these were the same offense under Blockberger, because simply looking at the elements of these offenses, they do not line up. And this Court's most recent precedent,
Counsel,
in Coleman...
Before we go further on that, you didn't have a chance to respond to the reply brief from the appellant, but in the reply brief, the appellant argues that because you didn't cross appeal, that you cannot argue that there was no double jeopardy violation. The only question is what the remedy should be. What's your response to that argument?
Your Honor, the government's response is that the issue that this court granted on was whether the double jeopardy clause required dismissal of appellant's convictions, and therefore it was a broad issue, and the government did not see a need to cross-certify if the fundamental question is the violation of the double jeopardy clause, which necessarily implicates the Army Court's opinion, and whether these offenses were the same offense for purposes of Blockberger and Teeters. And thus comparing the elements under the Blockberger test, and more recently under this court's precedent in Coleman, looking at the terminal element and what appellant calls the jurisdictional elements of these offenses, they are different. And to hold that they are the same offense for purposes of double jeopardy would fly in the face of this court's precedent in Roderick, which suggests that there is no authority to disregard jurisdictional elements in these sorts of cases, even looking at multiplicity. So because there are different elements at play in this case, there are, in fact, different offenses.
I'm like struggling with this case, right? Because it seems to me that the founders, if they saw what had happened here, that their heads would explode. And so explain to me, given the fact that Article 134 is incredibly malleable, do you disagree with that statement?
No, Your Honor, I do not.
Right, and it was intended to be infinitely malleable, right? And given the proliferation of federal statutory offenses, it seems to me that your argument is that it would always be okay for a military member to be subject to trial in federal district court under 18 U.S.C. 2252 alpha, in military court under Article 134, Clauses 1 or 2, and also in state court under a state law prohibiting the possession or distribution of child pornography. Is that your argument?
Your Honor, I think turning to this court's precedent in Martinelli and Medina, when we look at the Army's ability to charge clauses 1 and 2 of Article 134, I certainly think that's possible. Although, as Your Honor noted, with the Justice Department's policy against the federal prosecutions and in the Army, AR-27-10, which requires a certain amount of approval for these kinds of prosecutions, I can't speak to the factual circumstances of what happened at charging in this case.
That doesn't answer my very specific question, which is it your position that it's perfectly fine for a military member to be able to be charged in federal forum A, right, which is district court, federal forum B, military court, and state court, all for the exact same underlying conduct, and that doesn't pose any constitutional problems whatsoever?
Your Honor,
because when the Supreme Court has looked at whether someone could be subject to a federal, like ACCA, right, the Assimilative Crimes Act, part of their concern was, we're not going to let someone be subject to trial in federal district court, basically three different ways, right? Which by a federal tribunal, like say on federal lands.
Your Honor, I think that under Blockberger and then under this court's precedent in Anderson, recently in Coleman, and our understanding of how the elements comparison works, our understanding is that it does not violate the double jeopardy clause so long as they're not the same offense, and that is a strict elements-based analysis in the absence of the written express intent of Congress. So I think the answer, Your Honor, would be so long as the offenses are different and the elements are different, then there's nothing that indicates that successive prosecutions...
Okay, so when determining whether elements are different, right, which is your argument, right, is that the elements are different here because there's a jurisdictional tie under 2252 alpha that it has to be, the matter has to have been transported in interstate commerce, right?
Yes, Your Honor, although...
Okay. Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and so explain to me why when applying the Blockberger test, given that double jeopardy is disfavored and given the fact that one would assume that subjecting someone to potential trial in not one, not two, but three different forms for the exact same conduct, why wouldn't we interpret that jurisdictional element as not relevant for purposes of the Blockberger test? Or alternatively, why wouldn't we look at Article 134 and say, gosh, Article 134 doesn't say anything at all about how it has to have been transported, and so therefore the jurisdictional clause which requires that it be transported in a particular way is a lesser included offense of Article 134's saying nothing about how something is transported.
Your Honor, first, I think the government disagrees with the description of a jurisdictional element. After all, the federal court must plead and prove, and the government must sustain its proof with respect that the items have actually traveled interstate commerce. If it's not pleaded, if it's not proven, then the motion to dismiss for failure of proof can be given. The same with an RCM 917 motion if we do not prove the terminal elements of Article 134. So looking at this court's precedent in United States versus Fossler, Martinelli, and Medina, specifically the cases that deal with the separate the disjunctive and conjunctive charging of Article 134 offenses. If the government fails to properly allege and properly prove at trial that the conduct was service discrediting, that it was prejudicial to good order and discipline, or if under a Clause 3 that it was a crime not capital, it will fail its burden of proof. So the government disagrees that one can disregard those elements as jurisdictional. Furthermore, the military ascertains—
Are you calling those jurisdictional elements prejudice to good order and discipline or service discrediting?
No, Your Honor, I'm disagreeing with the description of jurisdictional elements with interstate commerce as a jurisdictional element.
Well, what do you do about all the Supreme Court cases that treat them as exactly that, and is slightly, albeit in a different context, but I mean, they are clearly called jurisdictional elements.
Understood, Your Honor, but looking at United States versus Roderick in the multiplicity context, when we are comparing elements out of the same double jeopardy right, when we are trying to look at whether an appellant can be convicted of multiple offenses for the same underlying conduct, they are not disregarded. Thus, in this case, they should not be by this court. But even if this court were to disagree with the government on the nature of the double jeopardy violation, appellant has already received his remedy in this case from the district court.
Can Roderick and Luna Torres be reconciled?
Yes, Your Honor, to the extent that I don't believe that Luna Torres addresses the multiplicity or double jeopardy context, so I don't know that it...
I'm sorry, I can't understand you.
I don't believe that Luna Torres addresses the multiplicity or double jeopardy context. Therefore, I don't necessarily think that Luna Torres has any bearing on whether this court should revisit Roderick. It certainly could. But if this court decides that there is a double jeopardy violation here, appellant...
So we shouldn't be looking at Luna Torres in terms of the Supreme Court specifically stating that is the substantive elements that define and describe the evil that Congress is trying to get here?
Yes, Your Honor, this court should certainly take note of that in Luna Torres, but to the extent that it doesn't then address the question of how we work Luna Torres into Blockberger and whether you were to disregard those elements for purposes of pleading and proof in a double jeopardy context.
But doesn't Puerto Rico versus Sanchez Valle tie those two cases together, where there the Supreme Court is saying the question under Blockberger is whether the separate prosecutions target the identical conduct, we had identical conduct here, through equivalent criminal laws. Now, there the Supreme Court was not saying identical criminal laws, they were saying equivalent criminal laws. And so when we're tying it back to Luna Torres, and the Supreme Court is saying it's the substantive elements, not the jurisdictional, that define the evil. Doesn't that say these two married together to show that this was double jeopardy when we had the same sovereign?
This counsel, I mean, it's fair, right, to say, okay, Congress can criminalize the same act in a couple of different ways, right, because it has different interests. But isn't that different here? Like, these are the same exact acts, plus or minus this jurisdictional element. And Grafton, though you're not familiar with it, says there is no uniquely military interest to be vindicated when we're talking about two arms of the same sovereign.
And yet, Your Honor, they do fall under two different statutory schemes, that being that Article 134 does allow us to criminalize different conduct. Regardless of whether there is a separate military interest, there is a separate statutory scheme.
There was two totally separate schemes in Grafton as well. I mean, they address this particular point.
And
I mean, albeit the Philippines law versus the military justice law, but it didn't matter. It was the source of the authority for the prosecution. In both cases, it was a constitution.
And
of
thus,
the United States, right? And in both cases here, Clause 1, Clause 3, right? But I mean, it's the same. I mean, it's the same constitution, different judicial systems.
Yes, Your Honor. And thus, if this court disagrees with the government and does find a double jeopardy violation, it should still find that no additional remedy is due to appellant. Because to the extent that appellant wishes to vindicate his right against a second prosecution, the government would like to draw the attention of the court to the charge sheet at Joint Appendix 27, where appellant was charged with a number of different offenses to include conduct on becoming an officer and other offenses. So to the extent that we're trying to avoid a second trial that ABNY says should be dealt with on interlocutory relief, to prevent the right from being violated in the first place. That is sort of a legal fiction at this point. And there's still a valid conviction for distribution that is wholly factually separate from that which was addressed in the district court.
So is it your position that as long as there's a second trial already going to take place, that the federal government, even in the civilian world, could add in identical prosecutions? That seems to be the natural consequence of your argument, right?
Your Honor, I think that's the factual consequence of this argument. In a perfect world, appellant might have vindicated the right against double jeopardy and against that second trial by filing interlocutory relief after his motion to dismiss was denied by the court-martial. Ideally, that is how we would have protected that right. But since that's no longer available to us, and because there were other bases of criminal liability upon which appellant's case was referred to court-martial, the idea that he wouldn't have been prosecuted a second time or brought to court for a second time, the abuse, embarrassment, et cetera, that ABNY is talking about, that cannot be undone. And so not necessarily in every case, Your Honor, but perhaps in this case, which is why further remedy isn't appropriate. Under Ball, at this moment, appellant only stands convicted of one possession offense, two separate distribution offenses, and he was only sentenced once. Therefore.
But you seem to be focusing on trying to prevent two convictions rather than two trials. Double jeopardy goes to two prosecutions, not to curing two convictions later on.
Yes, Your Honor, but there are those three separate rights that are protected by the Double Jeopardy Clause, the right against multiple prosecutions, the right against multiple convictions, and then the right against multiple punishments. And therefore, when we're looking at simply the right not to be hailed into court that second time, in this particular case, it appears that that is a bit of a legal fiction because there were other bases of criminal liability that were referred to trial.
It's a legal fiction, or is it just because this thing's so screwed up?
Your Honor, because there were other bases of criminal...
I'm not commenting on the quality of your argument or anything like that.
It's certainly your prerogative, Your Honor, but...
Major Parnell, can I get down to kind of brass tacks here? To what extent should we be focusing on what the framers would have thought of this? We've got the same sovereign, we've got the same child pornography, we've got the same electronic media, we've got the same date. Should we be looking at, would the framers have conceived of this as being double jeopardy? Should we venture there or not?
Your Honor, I think that under the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, it would be best to sort of solve this on a question of remedy rather than a question of constitutional interpretation. But to the extent that the court wishes to analyze the double jeopardy clause and go back to what the framers would have thought, it is the stated law of the Supreme Court under Dixon and Blockberger that we analyze Congress's intent to punish based on the strict Blockberger elements test. And therefore, when we compare these elements, certainly this court can disagree with the government as to the nature of the interstate commerce element, but looking at our understanding of constitutional law and how we assess whether something is violative of the Double Jeopardy Clause in accordance with Congress's intent and its ability to legislate, the elements test is the way to go. And so analyzing what the framers may or may not have thought about this perhaps takes it a bit far, but it is within this court's prerogative.
Counsel, given the way this issue is framed, I think we're long past constitutional avoidance and ashwander and all that. The government, as I understand it, is basically saying that the appellant chose his remedy, or maybe the remedy chose him, because That's what he got first. And then when he tried the same thing at ACCA, it didn't work. But having gotten his remedy, that's all he gets. That being the case, is that the government's contention?
Yes, Your Honor. Double jeopardy should be reduced to single jeopardy, okay. Not no jeopardy.
Not no jeopardy.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, then the way things are now, that, you know, the charge's been dismissed in the U.S. District Court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Goes away. Can the Army now resuscitate it?
Your Honor, I think that if this court were to find that this prosecution invalidated appellant's conditional guilty plea to the extent that the district court vacated the possession count, the answer might be yes, because the vacating of that possession count would indicate that it's as though appellant was never prosecuted in that court. So it is possible, I think, that if the conditional guilty plea went away, then in theory, the federal government could try again on the possession.
But does that vindicate his right against successive prosecutions? Like the fact that it went away in district court after he'd already been subject to successive prosecutions for the same conduct? Right, because I mean, that's what the concern is, right? Is the harassment, the mental anguish, the concern of being harassed, basically, and the notion of letting them go at it and, you know, as a dress rehearsal for the next trial, right? Those things don't go away because the district court charge went away, do they?
No, Your Honor, they don't. But they also, at this point, cannot go away. And turning again to Abney, that is why when we're facing a successive prosecutions problem under the Double Jeopardy Clause, the ideal remedy is interlocutory relief, a writ of mandate.
So what the appellant got wrong here then is that he should have filed an interlocutory appeal when his motion to dismiss his charges on double jeopardy grounds was denied? I mean, what did he not do that he should have done?
Chief Judge Stuckey, I see my time has expired.
Please answer the question.
Your Honor, it's not necessarily that he should have done that or that the government requires him to do it. It is simply saying that for purposes of remedy, the ability to make appellant whole for the successive prosecution's right may be beyond this court's purview at this moment in time under these facts. And thus, because there were other charges on the charge sheet, the court-martial was always going to happen, and then the sentencing proceeding at the district court may have alleviated the question of multiple punishments and vacated one of the convictions. What more can we give appellant that would make him whole for a right that has essentially already been violated?
Well, why couldn't we affirm the CCA's dismissal of the charges?
Your Honor, you certainly could, but at that point, again, double jeopardy should not be reduced to no jeopardy. It should be single jeopardy. And because appellant at this moment stands convicted of one possession offense and two wholly distinct and separate distribution offenses, there is no more double jeopardy error to resolve.
Counsel, if we were to rule in the manner in which you would like us to rule, why wouldn't that open the door to multiple prosecutions around the country for a host of different offenses, not just child pornography, where there essentially is collusion between the AUSA and the trial counsel, and say, let's go at this guy or gal a couple different times, we'll find out where we get the best sentence, we'll go through a dress rehearsal, and it would really be a situation where we would see this issue come up again. Why wouldn't this be opening the door?
Your Honor, at least speaking only for the Army, Army Regulation 27-10 Military Justice does provide a process for preventing that from happening. Again, I cannot speak to the charging decision in this case. It appears that perhaps under a misinterpretation of the law pre-Forrester, that the AUSA and the trial counsel
were— Okay, but how would we, you're citing AR 2710, how would we as a court rule here? How would we frame it so that it would not be a scenario where I just explained, where this was constantly taking place in courts martial and in federal courthouses?
Your Honor, I certainly think that this court could limit this opinion to the facts and circumstances of this case, and this court has certainly spoken to its the way that it prefers for trial counsel, chiefs of justice, and SJAs to address military justice prospectively, I think that this court could limit this case to its facts, limit any remedy or ruling to United States versus Rice without necessarily opening the door to further prosecution.
Well, so even in this case, how do we know whether and how the procedures of 2710 were conformed with? And do we even have a right to ask that question? I mean, that's not our business, right? That's the administrative portion of the military justice system. Right, so I mean, do you know? I mean, were the procedures in 2710 followed in this case? It's not in the record.
Your Honor, it's not in the record, and thus I have no basis to comment on what was or was not done in United States versus Rice, other than to say that if this court wishes to send a message to trial counsel, it can certainly do so. But pending any further questions from this court, it should affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
May it please the court, let me briefly just respond to the questions that I received right at the end. Judge Stuckey, to your waiver point, I think if you check out page 56 of the joint appendix, you'll find in the last paragraph, that's the appellant's motion to dismiss in the military, in the court-martial. And I think what you'll see in the last paragraph of JA 56 is that the appellant did indeed refer to the possibility that the distribution offenses were themselves, the distribution specifications were themselves a violation of double jeopardy. There was at that point in the proceeding, Chief Judge Stuckey, some lack of clarity.
Indeed.
And so I think from the perspective of did appellant waive, I would respectfully refer this court to that paragraph of the motion as suggesting that no, he did not.
All the discussion, even in the 802, was the motion.
And
nothing else. And I understand your contention is that it got into the motion, albeit kind of maybe.
Well, I mean, if I can be a little more concrete than that, Chief Judge Stuckey, what I would say is I think the motion clearly outlines that the appellant was also concerned about the distribution specifications, that the state of the proceedings at that point made it hard for appellant to crystallize his objections. And if I may, the government at no point has argued that appellant waived the challenge to the distribution specifications, I think reflecting that the appellant did everything he could. To Judge Ryan's points, so Judge Ryan, on Grafton, I mean, I certainly agree that in a world in which Grafton were the Supreme Court's last pronouncement on this question, this would be an even easier case for us. I think the tricky part is that the court has looked more carefully in subsequent cases, not at the potential idea that two different arms of the federal government are prosecuting similar looking offenses, but at a rigid comparison of the offenses without regard to whether it's two different arms of the federal government or the same arm. And so we think Grafton obviously is helpful. We think it's not nearly as conclusive as some of the later precedents that we also think cut in our favor. On the interstate commerce point, I actually think, first of all, my understanding of 134.2 is that as charged in this case, no, there was no requirement that the government had to show that the material traveled through interstate commerce for the 134.2 specification. If anything, though, I think that underscores the overlap in the offenses, because if we take out the interstate commerce element from 2252AA5, now they're exactly identical. Right now, they actually completely mirror each other in the way that I think Blockberger understood to be the same offense, in the way that the founders would have understood to be the same offense. And if I might step back for a second, Your Honors, the government, I think, once again, takes the rather interesting position that the appellant could have pursued an interlocutory appeal under Abney. That's just not true. This court, the CCAs, have never recognized a statutory interlocutory appeal. Perhaps appellant could have sought an extraordinary writ. We could find no instance in which a CCA granted an extraordinary writ out of a double jeopardy concern to bar a second trial. It's just, from our perspective, it's not clear what else appellant could or should have done. In contrast to the government, and I think this is the point that I would harp on, is when we went back to the district court and moved to not sentence on count one, the government had multiple options available to it at that point. That would have avoided this. The government could have asked Chief Judge Connor to defer sentencing until the Army Court ruled on our appeal. The government could have asked Chief Judge Connor to defer sentencing and defer ruling on the motion until the convening authority had a chance to approve or reject the findings based on these double jeopardy concerns. To impute that to the appellant, to suggest appellant elected his remedy, I think requires a rather one-sided reading of the record. There is, you know, the court suggested at various points during the argument that this case is a head-scratcher, that it's messy. The Army Court referred to it as a debacle, and we agree with all of those characterizations. I think the relevant point is, how do we avoid it from happening again? And it seems like there's an easy way to avoid it from happening again, which is, however you decide the double jeopardy piece of it, to hold that appellant did not receive a remedy, leave everything to be decided going forward. Counsel for the government was asked four different times during the argument how affirming the Army Court would avoid the specter of the government doing exactly what it did here on a larger scale, of charging the same defendant multiple times in multiple forms with the same offense, of trying him multiple times for the same offense, and only picking one sentence to defend an appeal. With all respect, I did not hear an answer from Major Parnell. And on that point, I think the government silence is deafening. And if there are no further questions, I thank the court for its time.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. The case is now submitted. The court will now recess in place for question and answer session. The only limit on questions and answers is no questions about the case, no questions about any other case pending before the court. Other than that, we are at your disposal. Our clerks are at your disposal, and counsel are at your disposal. So with that, take it away.